Welcome to the Australian Institute of Administrative Law podcast, which aims to be a forum for discussion of issues concerning the law of government in Australia. My name is Robert Orr. I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We pay our respects to their elders past and present. Today I'm delighted to welcome Professor Robin Craik to the podcast. Robin is an outstanding figure in Australian public law, a leading academic, author, tribunal member and administrator, and former president of the Institute. It is great to have her here to talk about her life, AIAL, and administrative law more generally. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you, Robert, for that warm welcome.
So, Robin, you've had a very full life in administrative law, which I briefly referred to in the introduction. Could you just say a bit more about the range of things that you've done?
Well, Robert, I think my history reflects the opportunities offered someone in my generation, which studying law provided. Indeed, immediately after I graduated, when I did the compulsory trip to UK and Europe, the fact that I had a law degree gave me an unexpected opportunity to work in casual jobs. So I ended up being an assistant to the editor of the Legal Encyclopedia, the Digest, which was earlier called the English and Empire Digest. And it also gave me an entree to a much less prestigious job, namely typing in a law office, simply because I could spell legal terms. I was a hopeless typist, I might add. Then, on my return to Australia in the late 60s, I ended up as a graduate trainee in the Department of Trade and Industry, now DFAT, of course, as I believe I was the only legally trained person in the then department. I was given the opportunity to do things like sit in on the IDC on Law of the Sea, chaired by the then legendary Sir Kenneth Bailey. I was involved in work by Australian mining companies, auspiced by the department, to set up an iron and steel institute in Singapore, and also to service a number of international organisations. And all this was as a very new graduate. Then I joined the ANU in 1973, and I took advantage of the university's one-day-a-week rule, which permits staff to take on other positions. So it enabled me to be a part-time member of a number of tribunals. For 6 years, I was a special counsel at Phillips Fox. I was a commissioner on the ACT's independent Competition and Regulatory Commission, deciding things like prices for electricity, gas, taxi licences, and who could adjust horses in Western Creek paddocks. I was also a member of the Administrative Review Council for some 10 years, and during that period was involved in some of the Council's most prestigious and seminal publications on judicial review, on automated assistance to administrative decision-making, contracting out of government services, and a group of us devised some administrative law training materials for the Australian Public Service. I also took leave part-time from the ANU to become a member of the ACT's registry of the AAT. And prior to that, I was the second integrity advisor to the ATO, a 2 to 3 day role. And I'm currently a member of a couple of committees of the Law Council of Australia, its Administrative Law Committee and the AAT Liaison Committee. And I'm one of 5 national appraisers for AAT members seeking reappointment. And interestingly, a member of the Australian Advertising Standards Board, a reviewer for them, when it hears complaints about TV and other forms of commercial advertising. So I could say that the law degree has opened many doors for me.
Yeah, you've certainly done an amazing array of things. And of course, as you mentioned, you've been a long-term Canberra resident for a while. But would you be able to tell us just a bit about your background, your family, and where you grew up?
All right. Well, listen, I was born in Bendigo, in Bishop's Court there, actually, because my mother had to move back home when my father went off to join the army. But post-World War II, my father, like so many servicemen, didn't particularly want to return to his pre-war occupation, so he joined the British Colonial Service, and he was posted to West Africa, firstly in British Cameroons, and then mostly for Nigeria, where he was for 20 years. So, age 3, I went to British Cameroons and was there until I was 5. But the downside of all of this was that there weren't schools. So at age 6, I was sent to a Perth boarding school and stayed there for the rest of my secondary education. It meant, sadly, that I saw regrettably little of my parents, although from 8 to 9, I did spend time with them in Cambridge and Nigeria before returning to school. So that's my background.
Yeah, so that must have been quite difficult for you, was it, studying in Perth so far away?
It was, and at the moment I'm actually transcribing my mother's letters to her mother during some of this period, and it's fascinating to read the impact on her of having to leave myself and my brother behind in Australia for very lengthy periods.
So did you study at the University of Western Australia?
I did. I did my law degree there and finished law. And after that, I got a job in Canberra.
Right. So were there any standout lecturers there at the university then in Western Australia?
Well, the foundation professor, Professor Beasley, I still remember him on the very first day I went into the law school. He wore a very long, greeny-black robe, and this was the era when everybody had to wear a gown to lectures. The girls were supposed to wear skirts and high heels and stockings, and the boys had to wear ties. It shows how long ago it was that I studied law, I think.
Absolutely. So you've mentioned your long career as an academic. So what do you think were your biggest challenges being a woman academic? And what do you think are the biggest changes since you started being an academic that you've seen?
It was interesting starting law in the early 70s. There were not that many women in the faculty or in the university as a whole. And indeed, I was on a university committee at one stage, which began the work of trying to encourage more women into academia. And we had to get an exemption under the Sex Discrimination Act to allow us to offer scholarships to women only. But interestingly, in terms of affirmative action, after about 5 years, we could ask for the exemption to be lifted. And now, of course, there are probably more women in law and teaching law and throughout the university than men. But at the time we started that program, the ANU had one of the worst records in the country, with only 3% of its staff were female.
So how about the changes you've seen in being academic from when you began to the present day?
Well, I think in academia, life has become a lot tougher. The competition for grants is certainly very fierce. The amount of work and administration has increased exponentially. I think the professionalism required has also improved, in fact. And I remember there was a not so long ago, there was considerable encouragement for people to go on and do some form of extracurricular teaching training so that they could be better teachers. Seems a little ironic at the moment when, of course, COVID-19 means that teaching has become an online exercise and some of those skills aren't required. But I'm a great believer in the importance of that personal contact, and that has been a significant development. But I think one of the downsides has been the increase in numbers. I can remember when the law faculty increased about fourfold and classes from 90 to 200. Now, classes of 200 is a number, or classes are a number which you can't respond to very easily. And as a consequence, the benefit for teachers of teaching, which is often to engage with your students, and particularly your interesting students, has gone down enormously. And perhaps the only students you really get to know now are those you supervise who are doing their honours, or those who become your research assistants. And I think that's a very sad reflection on today's academia. That plus the competition means that I think teaching has suffered.
Yeah, thanks for that. So you've had a long-term involvement in the Australian Institute of Administrative Law. Can you remember what your first experience of it was?
I was actually in that very first gathering of administrative lawyers in Canberra in 1989 when the IAL was set up. I still remember at that meeting Jeff Colts, a former ombudsman, who had drafted the original constitution, taking amendments from the floor to that constitutional document. So that was my very first introduction to AIAL, and it means, of course, that I'm a foundation member of the Institute.
So what do you think are the biggest issues which the Institute has been involved in and promoted discussion on?
Well, perhaps the biggest single issue, in my recollection, was when it promoted discussion on the moves by government in 2000 and 2001 to amalgamate federal tribunals under the AAT umbrella. The AIAL ran a half-day seminar at Old Parliament House on the topic. Speakers were from all political parties and many eminent academics and practitioners. And at the end of the day, I believe that conference was pivotal in the government's decision to withdraw the legislation at that time. It was indeed a notable outcome, since then the legislation to effect the amalgamation, and it was in more than one act, contained more pages than any other act or related series of acts since Federation. So it was a major back down by government. And of course, ultimately, government achieved what it wanted in 2015, and the amalgamation took place. But I think the interim of 15 years break was probably salutary, in that the final model owes much to many of the criticisms that came out of that first seminar. Other key issues speared by the Institute have been promotion of the concept of administrative justice and how its achievements are or should be assessed. Perhaps most importantly, the Institute has widened people's eyes to the breadth of administrative law. It's not just about judicial review principles, important though these are. There are a host of other bodies, from anti-discrimination to human rights to anti-corruption, native title, merits review, negotiated outcomes, regulation, monitoring operations. All of these are a rich source of legal remedies against actions by government, and in some cases private sector bodies, which have produced adverse impacts for people. And I think the AIAL has done a considerable amount of work in raising people's awareness of these avenues.
Yes, I agree with that. I mean, of course, when I studied administrative law, it was almost wholly judicial review. And even now, some people sort of see most things through the lens of judicial review. But the reality is that, of course, these other mechanisms are usually far more important.
They are.
In terms of the people who are affected by government decisions.
And indeed, Robert, your history reminds me of one aspect of my life too, because when I studied law, I finished up having to do a 3-day honours degree, and that essay that I did was on the prerogative writs. And we had, for administrative law, it was 12 months on the prerogative writs.
Right. Yeah. So you've said quite a bit about AIAL. How would you generally describe the work that it's done and the impact that it's had on the administrative law system?
Well, I think above all, the AIAL has developed a community of like-minded people, those who are interested in law and government. It's been, from its inception, a national body, and indeed the strength of many of the Institute's state chapters is a recognition of the need for that community. A particular example of that impact was the inclusion of, for example, a group which had never previously had contact with administrative law. And I speak here of those involved in regulating guardianship and management of property. Now, that area of the law, as you know, originated in the parens patriae jurisdiction, which was administered by courts exercising an equity jurisdiction. But the days when court processes were required had passed. And indeed, even in Australia, guardianship and property management boards had been set up around Australia, but they were isolated. Today, that same function is now conducted, for the most part, by civil and administrative tribunals throughout the country, firmly bringing that group within the administrative law camp. And as an illustration of that, I well remember a member of that guardianship and management of property cohort, after attending an AIAL annual conference, rejoicing that at last he'd found a home. So that's, I think, one of the important outcomes of what the AIAL has done. Now, community aside, I think the practice of holding annual conferences every second year in a state, that is, gradually marching around the continent and encouraging state chapters to run regular seminars and be involved in other initiatives like student essay competitions, has supported and maintained interest in administrative law throughout the country, and certainly it too has kept that sense of community alive. So that feature, coupled with the wealth of published material under the AIAL logo, has certainly had an important role in promoting administrative law in this country.
Yeah, thanks for that. And just following on from that issue, of course, you are now currently and have been for quite some time the principal editor of the AIAL Forum, the journal of the Institute. Excitingly, the forum will have its 100th edition later this year. What has been your approach to the editorial role, and what do you see the strengths of this publication?
Well, from its inception, the Forum was never intended to be a predominantly scholarly journal with well-footnoted and researched articles rivaling the university and other academic journals. It was designed to be practical in focus, dealing with day-to-day issues of practicing public lawyers. And I've maintained that philosophy and I believe it's the journal's strength. So although the journal does offer refereeing to academics who need that academic recognition, that has not been the main thrust of its publication. People who do not have academic backgrounds but do have an important point to make about an aspect of administrative law can have their views published in the forum, and I think it thereby has filled a very important niche.
Yeah. So do you have any favourite articles from the forum or favourite presentations or moments or lectures or seminars?
Well, there are, of course, a few that come to mind, but there are so many excellent articles in the over or the nearly 100 editions of the journal that it's hard to choose. But I do particularly recall Marcia Neave's paper, In the Eye of the Beholder, Measuring Administrative Justice. I think this was in about 1991. She gave that paper at a conference. And in that paper, she attempted to develop objective measures about how you could gauge the impact of administrative law institutions. And certainly that's one paper that stands out. I might add that developing such measures is a task which still needs considerable work. The recent development section of the journal is, I believe, a rich source of case analysis, and the current and long-standing editor, Catherine Cook, also provides copies of topical media reports, which are always very informative, and I think they too are valuable to keep administrative law community up to date. A more recent example has been Sarah Mould's article, Committees of Influence, The Impact of Parliamentary Committees on Lawmaking and Rights Protection in Australia. And I think this was a novel look at an underexplored area of rights protection in this country. And I'm a bit of a fan of Sarah's as a consequence. As for lectures and national lectures, I still remember Robert French's keynote address to an early 1990s annual conference titled Administrative Justice in Australian Administrative Law. That really established the notion of administrative justice. That is, justice found in bodies outside the court system. And I should add that though he and I share this notion of the essence of what administrative justice means, the expression can be used in different ways by others. Other papers that I particularly remember, Sir Anthony Mason's three lecture series in our national lecture program, was, as you might expect, a tour de force, covering his views on judicial review, but also he did a comparative examination of Australian administrative law with administrative law in other countries with similar legal systems, and that was very interesting. So those are just a few of the papers which I particularly remember.
Yeah, thanks for that. There's certainly a wide range of material which the Institute has promoted. But as well as articles and presentations, there've been a wide range of people involved in the Institute over the years, some of them quite colourful personalities. Are there any that stand out particularly for you as being important to the Institute?
Well, I suppose because I've been involved in the Institute from the beginning, I particularly remember its early secretariat, long-standing secretariat, and the personalities of Jenny Kelly and Kathy Malcolm, who ran it. They were such supportive people for the Institute, and, as I might add, is the current secretariat, particularly Sue Hart. So they were central key figures. Other key people Dennis Pierce and his practice of asking pointed questions of speakers at national conferences meant that he could always be relied upon to break that inevitable ice at a conference. And we were always very grateful to Dennis for that. And I still remember Michael Sasella's controversial intervention at one conference when he denounced tribunals for neglecting or not following government policy. And that was a really dramatic and memorable moment at a conference. And finally, I think it would be remiss of me not to mention also Stephen Argument, secretary for over 20 years, who certainly left his mark on the institution. I believe your work, Robert, in the technological space has been vital to the ability of the AIAL to reach a wider audience. And Peter Sutherland, our long-standing treasurer's hands on the financial tiller, have ensured that the Institute remains solvent and sufficiently well-resourced to fulfil its mandate. So those are just some of the personalities that spring to mind.
Okay, thanks for that. So I just wanted to ask a few questions about administrative law more generally. So what do you see as the most significant developments in administrative law since you've been a lawyer?
Well, I suppose my own history has illustrated these developments. As I mentioned a little while ago, my thesis after a year of administrative law study was on the prerogative writs. And from there to where we are now, with this multiplicity of bodies to which people can turn in administrative law, is perhaps the most significant change to the landscape. I don't know whether you know A.J. Brown's bird's nest, his imagery, but I think it's a very apt picture of the number and complexity of the interactions of administrative law bodies, which together combine to ensure government accountability in this country. And the change from the reliance on prerogative writs to this situation is startling in just 50 years. Other major changes have been, I suppose, firstly, the identification and listing of grounds of review in the ADJR Act. It certainly performed a very important step in administrative law. As a teacher, it made it much easier to teach the subject, certainly than in the days when it was about the prerogative writs. Another key development has been the emergence of tribunals and merits review as major features of the legal landscape. After all, it is those bodies which are more accessible to most people, most of whom couldn't afford court processes, which are their contact with the law during their lifetime. So that's an important development. And I think too, something that I'm very conscious of working in my current roles is that the education of the public sector about the limits of their powers have led to a much more disciplined and legally aware public service. And that too has been a significant development.
So looking to the current day and into the future, what would you see as the top issues or challenges for our administrative law system at the moment?
Well, this is a current, very real interest for me, but I believe that automated assistance with decision making and its impact on administrative law principles is certainly one of the top issues for the future. Is an automated decision a, quote, decision in terms of the ADJR Act or the AAT Act? What becomes of discretion and the exercise of judgment when an automated system makes the decision? How can government efficiency be maintained while still permitting potential challenges to decision making when it's made by a system which can't actually be mined for the process. So these, I think, are challenges we are only just now beginning to address. I came across a quote from a couple of American writers who said that fitting machine learning into the regulatory state may turn out to be one of the most fundamental challenges facing the government system in the decades to come. And I think that quote sums up my own view about this area of the law. So that's one of the challenges. I mentioned a moment or two ago the importance of carving out separate grounds, even although they do overlap to an extent, in the ADGR Act and how important a development that had been. We have recently seen the retreat from nominated grounds and the well-established cases on each to a more nebulous concept of jurisdictional error. And I think potentially this is a retrograde step. Some degree of amalgamation of the two approaches will, I believe, be needed in the longer term. Another of our institutions, which probably needs some attention, is the National Native Title Tribunal. I think the length of the process is not sustainable, and some less time-consuming procedure for sorting out native title rights will be needed in future. Another issue, as I see it, is that the tendency for ombudsman officers to be used by government to take on ever more functions, straddling both the public and the private sector, because this can dilute the key functions of individual complaint handling and own motion reviews, which are the core functions of that office. And I think this is a tendency which needs to be watched. Another couple of issues are establishing the appropriate province of executive power and developing better ways to challenge its exercise. And finally, a topic dear to my heart, I think tribunals need to learn better how to carve out their special role and develop their special processes if they are to avoid becoming too court-like. And this certainly is a challenge that I've long been aware of.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with that. That you know, sometimes the emphasis in that sometimes tribunals can see themselves as sort of quasi courts or they mirror courts, which is probably not always appropriate or not always appropriate.
Current ones certainly.
So, what advice would you give someone starting out as a public lawyer now?
That was an interesting question. I think I would say to them, read newspapers, listen to and if you can visit Parliament, have a good grasp of Australia's political history, visit a tribunal or two, sit in on some court hearings, but before you do so, find out what the tribunal or court matter is about, because otherwise you won't get much from the visit. And above all, imagine having to defend yourself against something which happens to all of us. For example, a fine for wrongful parking when the only money-taking machine in the vicinity is malfunctioning. And see how the process unfolds and how many steps you have to take to get to an outcome. But go through those processes in order to understand what public law and administrative law can do for you.
That's great advice. So do you have a favourite case?
That's a really hard one, Robert.
Sorry.
I think it's impossible to say. But one which leapt out at me, and perhaps it's because of the focus at the moment on Black Lives Matter, but the Crown against TUI ex parte Northern Land Council, the Kenby Land Claim case, a claim by Indigenous people to land south of Darwin, has finally been settled after nearly 40 years, a figure which indicates why I'm concerned about the lengthy process of the National Native Title Tribunal. But I think what stands out about that case is that the persistence of the claimants and the many issues, how you challenge making delegated legislation, constitutional issues such as the powers of the Crown, etc., raised by that case. But the final success of those claimants, I think, illustrates the significance of this case to our Indigenous community, even if it does also highlight the problems with the Indigenous land rights recognition process.
Yeah, that's a very interesting choice. And while we're on favourites, leaving aside academic writings, do you have a favourite book which deals with the law or legal processes or government?
That too is a hard one. But can I just say that Peter Temple's The Broken Shore, although a detective story, is sufficiently close to the law and so beautifully written and in a way which I could relate to that I very much enjoyed it. And in terms of a perhaps more mainstream legal case, Nick Haslick's The Bradshaw Case, again about an Indigenous issue, of course, in Western Australia, is another book that I very much enjoyed reading, not least because Nick was at law school when I was there too, so I knew him from those days. And interestingly, when his father was Governor General, he came to Canberra and went to Canberra Grammar School, and he and my husband were at school together, so the links with Nick have always been long-standing.
Right. And what do you do when you're not being a lawyer and an academic, Robin?
Well, I read newspapers. I read my telephone. I read detective novels. And I read a range of other books. Fortunately, I was persuaded to join a mixed-gender book group a couple of years ago. And what I find fascinating is to hear the views of others on the same piece of writing, because inevitably it raises issues, or their views raise issues, which I hadn't even contemplated. So I enjoy that very much. I have grandchildren in Adelaide and I try and visit them as often as I can. Sometimes I try and visit my daughter in London or catch up with her there. I garden, I love cooking, and of course maintaining contact with key friends. So all of those are things I do in my spare time.
Yeah, wonderful. So this is my last question on favourites. Have you got a favourite piece of music or composer?
Well, I was thinking about that. I was asked once by somebody who was possibly going to do some lead light for my house, what was the piece of music he should play while he was constructing the work? And the piece of music that came to mind was Ravel's La Mer, the Sea. And I also know that I really enjoy Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Princess. So obviously Ravel is a musician that I have, or a composer that I have taken a shine to.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today, Robin. It's been wonderful. I wish you well in your many future endeavours. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Robert, for giving me these opportunities to talk.